What's up guys, welcome back to Rebranding Safety. Today we're talking to a rugby player, not just any rugby player, not just a fake rugby player like me, a professional Premiership and European Championship winning rugby player. That's right, let's jump into the intro and I'll explain it all.
The problem in safety isn't deviation, it's complexity.
Health and safety has gone mad.
Health and safety is trying to unpick having gone mad in the past.
There's no one solution and one problem. The problem is that we are looking for one solution.
Does the structure of the team allow them to flourish?
Feel safe enough to be uncomfortable.
The environment defines our behaviours.
People aren't the problem, they're the solution.
Rebranding Safety, crushing a stereotype. Brought to you by Risk Fluent. What's up guys, welcome back to Rebranding Safety, the podcast and YouTube channel doing exactly what it says on the tin. We do that through long form conversations, interview like today on the podcast, and do it by shorter tip toolbox talks, tips and tricks, etc. on the YouTube channel. So if you're new here, hit that follow button, subscribe button, bell button, whatever the button is on your platform. Today we're talking to a professional, Premiership winning, European Championship winning rugby player, turned into a leadership and culture consultant, probably the best word to describe it, even though he didn't really consider himself a consultant. Now, please don't go anywhere just because I said I'm talking to a rugby player because you think, oh, he's gone off tangent, he's not talking about safety. There is so much in managing the culture of a rugby team that translates into whatever you want to call it, safety culture or culture or whatever. This stuff works. This is, you have to stop thinking about, it's a safety podcast, we're just going to talk about risk assessments and method statements and safety two and safety one and like all this stuff translates, and there is bits that we can take from sport and learn from sport and implement in what we do. So please bear with this and kind of skim over the rugby phrases and terms and names and teams. I think about what we're actually talking about, which is culture and leadership and creating an environment which enables people to perform, whether that is in the corporate environment or in the oil and gas environment or in manufacturing or in sport. It's all the same. This guy caught my eye because somebody shared this video about talking about leadership, and the team that he played for is the team that I talk about quite a lot. In training or in keynotes or whatever, and I mention it because every interview I've seen, every Instagram video I've seen, every blog I've read about this team, they all comment about the culture, about how they just don't want to go anywhere, and that resonates with how you see them perform on the pitch. So for me, like, yeah, I've just had them in my notes for a long time, as you know, if I ever get the opportunity to talk to somebody from that team, then pounce on it. So I saw this person's video. They started a business called the Saracens Way. There we go. That's the team, Saracens. You know, massive Premiership winning, annoyingly good rugby team. You know, as a Saints fan, pain, like real pain to get this gentleman on the podcast. Currently gone through a bit of a scandal with salary caps. So basically, for those of you who don't know rugby, there's a cap on the salaries that you can have within a team. So basically, you can have like two marquee players who paid a lot more than most. So they're like normally like your big hitters or your big scorers, etc., or your real international kind of amazing players. Other than that, there's basically like a set level. I don't know the ins and outs on it, but basically there's a limit on how much you can spend, right? And it was found that Saracens were breaching that, which is a shame because it kind of tars everything that they've achieved over the months, and that everyone will say, you know, it was all to the pay. But anyway, we'll talk about that in the podcast. We're also going to talk about player safety as well, which I think is really interesting, and you can't pass up an opportunity of having a safety professional or a professional rugby player in a interview and not talk about player safety. So we talk about player safety as well. But who is our guest? Our guest is a Saris through and through. Like, you cut him in half, he's black and red. Is that their colours? Yeah, black and red. You know, he's there throughout the whole thing, as are most of the Saris players, really. And he'll tell you his story, but, you know, he suffered a bit of injury through the time, but, you know, it just does not take away from his victories. You know, he's held that Premiership trophy, he's held that European Championship trophy, and it's just phenomenal achievements. And now he's got a business called The Saracens Way, which he runs on helping businesses kind of work through leadership and culture and just improve your kind of performance efficiency through looking after your people, essentially. So without further ado, let's get into today's podcast with Will Fraser, Premiership and European Championship rugby player.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you a shameless sponsorship clip. In all seriousness, guys, we've partnered up with DRM Group. You know David McLean, he's been on the podcast time and time again. We absolutely support his message, and he's got a brand new online course to help you. I'm going to let him tell you all about it now.
The brain can be trained to think and behave differently, to think in more positive and optimistic ways. And there are steps that you can take to train your brain to feel good for good. And we call this lasting positive change. Through our 16-day program, which includes daily videos and action sheets, taking you no longer than 15 minutes to complete a day, you will learn how to move away from thoughts of anger, hopelessness and frustration to a place of mental well-being and positivity.
Okay, guys, so if you're interested, you can click the link below and get a discount, special rebranded safety discount. Full disclosure, we get a little bit kickback from that. So at the same time as improving your mental health, you can support your favourite health and safety podcast and YouTube channel. I'll let you get back into the content.
Cool. Right. Well, I never ever thought I would have a Premiership winning rugby player on a health and safety podcast, but welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. To be honest, I never thought I'd be on a health and safety podcast. So I'm excited.
Well, you're joking. You didn't turn up at Sarri's on the first day and be like, one day I'm going to go on a health and safety podcast.
Yeah, I went straight to the media team when I saw my first fresh of contract and said, if there's one thing I want to do, put me on a health and safety podcast for sure.
I believe you. Yeah. Do you want to give yourself an introduction, for the people who don't know who you are?
Yeah, sure. So my name's Will Fraser. I'm an ex-professional rugby player for Saracens. Very fortunate to win both European and Premiership trophies whilst I was playing for the club about 2.5 years ago now, or maybe just more. Had a bad neck injury that forced me to retire from professional rugby, and since then I've been running the Saracens Way, which is essentially a programme, kind of management consultancy business, where we look at what's made the club successful and how that translates into the corporate world, which has been more difficult of late, not just because of coronavirus, but because of recent issues that have happened with the club. But change nonetheless, yeah, so that's kind of a synopsis on me, if you like.
Awesome. Let's call the elephant in the room then. So obviously, yeah. Sorry, let's get it out of the way with, so we don't have to come back to it again. Cool. So I would be amiss if I didn't mention it, but I'm going to mention it. We to be upfront, we spoke before and double check that you're happy to kind of chat about it. I don't want to go into it too much, but I do feel like it feels a bit of a shame, because it will inevitably tar the kind of good that they've done all the time. So we'll talk about, and I still think it stands, everything that we'll talk about, but we'll talk about kind of the culture of Saris and everything I've kind of heard over the years of how impressive that culture seems to be, to develop that kind of that amount of talent and to win that much silverware and just be goddamn unbeatable at sometimes as a Saints fan, which just pains me. But it's gonna come back to a point where people are just gonna say, well, that's because they're all paid loads. And but it's not just the pay, is it? Like, can't be just that keeps people in a job.
No, not at all. I think it's, you're right. The sad part about it is, and understandably, it does undermine kind of everything we've done the last 10 years. And for those of us that were fortunate enough to be part of the club throughout that 10-year period, it does kind of tarnish and tar what we were able to achieve with the club. That's the sad part about it. The reality is, you're right. It's not, money doesn't keep people. Money doesn't keep you at a job for 10 years. There's got to be more to life than just money. And the reality is, actually, yeah, there's loads of detail to it, and salaries and these investments and all the rest of it. But the reality is, it had absolutely bugger all to do with why we are successful. I know, being part of the club from kind of what we call the revolution back in 2009, and we had this massive kind of change at the club, in personnel and culturally. I know the work that went into making that a reality. I know how hard I worked throughout that successful 10-year period, how hard all the players worked, the coaches, the staff and what really made us the club we are. Like, I know that, all the players know that. And to be completely frank, it had nothing to do with the salary cap stuff. Now, to caveat that, by no means is that me saying that we're innocent. Right? That's not what I'm saying at all. Clearly, we've been caught. Clearly, we were wrong. We shouldn't have done what we've done. That's very black and white for all to see. But yeah, the sad bit as an ex-player is kind of everything I've said, is that it does undermine what we've done. And I know we've spoken, a few of us ex-players actually spoke about it and just said we kind of, because it is sad for us because we can't do anything about it. It's, you know, and you want to be, you see your best mates kind of getting dragged through the mud and you want to be there to help and do what you can. And is that Addy Hargreaves actually said to me, he said, look, at the end of the day, the only thing that matters is that we know what we did. And we know, as I say, we know how hard we work. We know the effort we put in. We know what's gone into creating this club that we created. And that's the most important thing. And that's been quite useful for me personally to kind of remember. But at the end of the day, we were wrong and we got caught for it and we got punished for it. So we now need to, as a club, accept that, deal with it and move forward and try and get back close to where we were pre all this stuff. Mm.
And I think if you compare it to what we're seeing, well, right now, if we were playing rugby, but like Leicester Tigers, you know, they've got a phenomenal collection of players, you know. Yeah. Debatable the England fly half, depends on what side of the fence you're on. And then you've got, you know, probably what UK's best winger there, and just an absolute ream of talent. Yet they're not performing. And for me, when I look at that, I just think, well, there's got to be something wrong in the camp, like in the culture side of it. Because let's be honest, George Ford's getting paid a lot of money. I mean, I don't know. Johnny May's going to get. I know Johnny May's just announced that he's moving on, but it was, you know, those people going to be paid a lot of money, and there's reams and reams of talent in there. All going to be paid a lot of money. I wouldn't be surprised if we're to find out that Sarries is not the only team that's done this. Let's be honest. But to move on from that. You've got to be able to look at that and go, well, there had to be something that Sarries were doing other than just paying people a lot of money to, one, keep the talent, but two, perform at that level for that sustained period as well. And that's got to be the culture.
And I think if you look at any sustainably successful, let's take sports as kind of the conversation we're having now, the obvious example. If you look at Leicester back in the day when they were dominating Europe and the Prem, they had a core of players that had been at the club for a huge amount of time. Some of them have only been at the club. If you look at Wasps, when they came through and had that ding-dong with Leicester for a good period of time, they're the same. The core of that team had only played for Wasps and been at the club for a huge period of time. If you look at our squad over the last, don't take 10 years because we had a few years of kind of building it, but over the last 5 to 6 years, the core of that squad have only ever been at Saracens, have only ever known Saracens. And the reason I make the point is that you're right. Money is not the main motivator or reason why teams are successful. The reason teams are successful is because there's a huge amount of social cohesion within that group. And you only create social cohesion by spending time with people, getting to know them, having face-to-face interactions. And when you look at our squad, you know, the group I came through with, so Jackson, George, Jamie, Faz, you know, we've all been playing rugby together since we were 15, 16 years old. Those boys have played every Saracens game together. They've played England games together. They've played British and Irish Lions games together. Mix that in with your Brad Barretts, Alex Goods, and these guys. Like, the level of cohesion between those guys is phenomenal. And what that leads to is the ability to know innately how someone's going to react to a certain situation, how to generally give feedback so that it's heard and used to get better. How to talk to someone in the heat of a moment, in a big pressure moment in the game, whatever it might be. And it's those tiny little things that add up to create this team where everyone's just on the same page. Everyone knows what they're doing. They know what their jobs are. They know what their roles are. They know how to adapt if something goes wrong. All these things that everyone talks about, but very few, not just sports teams, but organisations actually are able to achieve. Because there's always this churn of people. So look at football. Very rarely in football do you get the same team that win the Premiership back to back. I know it's happened a couple of times with City and Chelsea, but it's quite a rarity. That's all right.
It's not coronavirus.
But the reason it's rare is because there's a constant churn of players. every year there's a handful of players that go out and there's brand new players that come in. A manager, I think the average lifespan for a Premiership manager is like 1.1 years or something.
Shocking.
So, and you look at Mark with us, he's been with us for 10, 11 years now. You look at Gatland and Edwards when they were with Wasps, they were there for a decent period of time. The same with Leicester and you know, the coaches they've had. And I think it's those things that people, that when a team becomes successful, people look and they go, oh, what are they doing here and now? But it's not. It's kind of 5 years before that. It's 10 years before that. It's where is it built from? And you've got to be patient and allow that to happen. And if it looks like it's going wrong, arguably that's the time you need to go back to this even more and trust it even more and not make these wholesale changes. So yeah, so going back to your question, appreciate I've gone on a bit of a waffle there, but going back to your question, what makes successful teams sustainably successful, not these one-hit wonders that win the league once and then drop down to sixth or seventh, but sustainably successful teams is the level of cohesion within that group of people.
And it's, you can, well, at least early on, and granted, I know now we're starting to see, which I think is inevitable, some players going out on loan and stuff like that, I think is inevitable. I don't think you could have avoided it. And to be fair, you know, everyone was quite clear early on that that's probably going to start happening. But when we were still playing rugby before this pandemic came along, the lads on the pitch just seems to be solidified. You know, it's not like you would see, what you would expect to see was that, you know, we're most probably going to get relegated, which would just be a shock to see Saris in the Championship. But, you know, you're going to get relegated. You would imagine to start seeing, like, you know, fractures in the teams and performances and lack of motivation. But, I mean, you were still winning games left, right and centre, and you were still just that same old annoyingly solid defensive line that you just can't get past. And it was just, and I remember watching the first few games after all this was coming out and consistently just thinking, Jesus, these core team of guys are just solid. It's just like you say, cohesion is probably the best way to describe it.
So I think what's interesting for us, because when the initial stuff came out, we still had a chance of staying up. So we only got the 35-point deduction. Mathematically, we could still stay up. So there was this huge push in the squad to kind of say, well, let's take this challenge on and see what we can do. You know, let's just play. And if we can stay up. And it is, you're right, it was a solidifying thing. And then, you know, we had a couple more punishments along the way. And we didn't really get a chance to, you know, there was the Racing Metro game at Allianz Park, which was the afternoon of the morning when we officially got told we had been relegated full stop, and we managed to win that game. You look at that and you go, for the lads to have to deal with all that, you know, and it's the lads you feel sorry for, because, you know, they're taking a hammering and they've got families and all this to think of. And so to deal with that and then put in that performance was monumental. And then the following week against Quinns, I think, was when you saw the accumulation of all the stress and probably anxiety and anticipation kind of manifest itself, and we got rightly hammered by Quinns. It was a shame it was Quinns, I have to say, from a personal point of view. I would have much rather it was a different team, but that's a different case. But I think the chat, but everything you said, that is our challenge now going forward, is actually in how we deal with this now will tell us how strong we were beforehand. So if we deal with it and the boys crack on with it and we get back up next year or whatever, then what that tells you is clearly what we had was real and was strong and was genuine and authentic. If, touch wood, it goes the other way, then you'd start asking different questions about what the previous 10 years was. Do you know what I mean? So I think for us, you know, we don't know what's going to happen is the reality of it. You know, we have no idea how things are going to plan out, especially with everything that's going on at the moment. But, you know, for us, the challenge is, how do we react to it? Do we go back to what made us successful over the last 10 years and use that as a foundation, or do we choose a different path? And for me personally, the only way we deal with this is by going back to what we did over the last 10 years, 100%, going back to the culture, going back to, but not doing it externally or for show or for anything like this, actually doing it for us. You know, who are we now as a club? What is our culture? What do our values mean to us now? Because very clearly and very publicly, they've come into massive question. You know, when we've got these four words on our stadium, everyone's kind of pointing, going, well, you didn't really live by that one, and rightly so. So we have to internally, first and foremost, figure out, well, how do you want to use these going forward? And that's a huge challenge, but equally huge exciting, because it gives us the opportunity to kind of, you know, reset, if you like, and actually start, because we are a different club now to what we were 10 years ago. 10 years ago, quite frankly, we were a rubbish rugby club. And now 10 years on, we're a very good rugby club that's been caught up in quite a big scandal. So we've now got to deal with these things. And it's in the... I often talk to people, a lot of the clients that I've spoken to since it all came out, the thing with culture and values is, I believe anyway, they're very aspirational. Yes, it's who you are, but it's also who you want to be. It's how you want to behave. So every single time, every single person will fall short of values at some point in their lives. Clearly, as a club, you know, I've done it individually, we all have, but as a club, clearly we've fallen very foul of our own values. But my belief is that it's not the falling foul of the values that's the problem. The problem is if you don't then use those values to get you back to where you need to be. Mm. That's the issue. If you don't use those values, then they were never really there in the first place. But if you use them, that's the telltale sign whether the values are real or not, or whether your culture is real or not, and whether the group is real or not. And that's a challenge for us now, is actually how do we do that? And we started the process of reevaluating what they mean to us, who we are as a club. So it'd be really exciting actually to go through that and see where we end up.
I love the way you talk about it. I love as well, you can tell that it's a strong kind of connection, being part of Saracens, the fact that, you know, you retired, but yet you still refer to it as we. So you can tell that, like,
yeah, you have it, yeah.
Yeah, that you're, yeah. That you're so
but ingrained if, in it. You know, it's for me personally, like, I didn't have a very smooth career in the sense that, I was like your Jack Wilshere rugby. I couldn't piece more than five games together without needing surgery or something else. And on paper, the club probably should have bid me off when I was about 23, 24. You know, I was a terrible return on investment, but they stuck by me, showed me loyalty beyond I ever deserved. When I had family issues with my brother's accident and stuff, the club were absolutely phenomenal during that whole period and even now. And, you know, we got told as academy kids by our team psych at the time, two bits of advice, which I've always tried. One was you should always give more than you take. And I think with the club, I've always tried to give more to the club than what I've taken from it. But with the kind of club it is, that's been impossible to do because they've given me so much. I could never really repay them for that. And the other one is you should always leave somewhere better than you found it. And again, it's that whole thing. I tried to do what I could to the club to leave it in a better place. And when I started, and I think in doing those things, actually, you inevitably learn to love somewhere. And the people I grew up with, you know, these are people I have no kind of qualms of saying it. Like, I love those guys. You know, they're my best mates. We've been through loads of stuff together. And so that affection for the club. And which is why I think for us ex-players, why it was quite hard for a few of us to accept kind of what had happened with the Saber Cup stuff. Mm. You know, you start looking at, right, well, how has this happened? Who's done what? But the reality is, it is what it is. It's now about how we, as I said, how we deal with it is what's important. Mm.
That's fascinating. So how do you, because I think from my point of view, I look at a lot of stuff in sport and there's a lot of people coming from sport now that are going to business conferences, and we're starting to see that connection between what you're doing there, that kind of sustainable performance relates to a business. So how do you take like that kind of 2009 journey, that revolution, like you say, and everything that you've learned and do it to businesses the Saracens way? Like, how do you do that with your client?
Yeah, so I think initially is it's the power of storytelling. So I think what's great about us is we've got a compelling story, and arguably with everything that's gone on, it's become even more compelling because it's kind of like, well, how do you then? But it's the power of storytelling. So people need something to hang their hat on. They need proof that something works. So it's all well and good saying you need to get on better with each other. You need to understand each other on a deeper level than just colleagues, because that will help you work better together. But unless there's kind of the proof there for them to see an example of where that's worked, then it's a bit box ticking. So I think what we've got is that proof. And then it's very much kind of making the point that actually initially anyway, in the early days, the reason we became very good at rugby, arguably in many ways, had actually nothing to do with the rugby. It was entirely to do with getting group buy and getting shared values, common goals, getting, you know, this whole kind of same page mentality on bigger picture, that it's not about me individually, it's about the group, and all these things, which every organisation wants to do. You know, there's not an organisation out there that doesn't want to achieve those things. So what our story demonstrates is the fundamental principles of why we're successful are no different to any organisation in any walk of life. Because actually the job's arguably the smallest bit of the organisation. You've got, you know, you've got these organisations with hundreds of employees or 10 employees. You want to get all those employees excited about coming to work, enjoying what they do, caring about the people they do it with, understanding the bigger objective of the organisation. So what we do is kind of take how we built that as a sports team, as a rugby team, how we went about that journey, and then kind of applying it to the context of the client. And I make no bones about it, I am not a consultant by any stretch of imagination. You know, I am someone that used to chuck a ball around for a living, and now I basically talk about the place where I used to do it. But what we do is facilitate, okay, well, how do you perceive this? So when we talk around our purpose as a rugby team, this is what our purpose is. This is our why. This is why we get up in the morning and do what we do. What is your purpose? And until you know what individually why you get up in the morning, you can't ever buy into what the organization are doing, because you'll always have this difference of opinion. And until someone else understands you as a person, how are they ever going to get the best out of you? So I often talk around this whole term of high performance in the corporate world is a complete oxymoron. Like it just doesn't work, because people say, oh, we want to squeeze every drop of performance out of our employees, we want to be a high performing organization. Yet the majority of people in the organization don't know what their colleagues, partners are called. They don't know where their colleagues grew up. They don't know why they're in that job in the first place. And for me, the biggest thing that impacts your performance at work is your personal life. You know, if you have a massive barney with your partner the night before, you're going to come in a stinking mood. If your pet's just died or you had a family bereavement, that's going to really impact you when you're at work. Now, if people don't know these things about you, they're going to assume that you're coming in a bit down, that you're just not being as productive as usual. So what then will happen is, rather than reach out and ask you, all right, they'll point their finger and, mate, I need this in by lunch, like, crack on. And all that does is put you in more of a negative spiral and the rest of it. Whereas if they know what your social norm is, they can see you're a bit down. How are you going? Are you all right? Look, take half hour, go have a coffee, whatever. I'll cover you for a bit. It's not a problem. That then sends you the other way. And I think this is where people don't understand, is they think, you know, you need, and it's not saying at all that you've got to bring all your darkest secrets into work with you and take all your work stuff back home. But it's how do you create an environment where people feel comfortable enough that if they have an issue, they can talk to someone at work about it, where they feel comfortable enough that if they disagree with someone, they can tell them and it's not going to be taken personally and all the rest of it. And that's the whole side of it. So as I say, this high performance thing, you can't get the most performance out of someone if you only know half the person. So when people say, well, we want to be a high performing organization, the first question you should ask, go, how well do you know your employees? Or how well do you know your team? Because until you know them well enough, you can't ever get the most out of them. So, it's an interesting, it's been really good learning for me, actually, to have to adapt the story into different contexts. I think what I've learned is that actually fundamentally successful sports teams, organisations, individuals, fundamentally are successful through the exact same principles. The difference is just the context in which they then apply those principles.
It's kind of like it's all the same stuff, but it's less obvious in the corporate world. So for example, so when you were talking about the family's connection and because I've got like the rugby brain on, I was thinking like at Saints, we had Louis Picamoel, who, you know, just broke my heart when he left because he was just phenomenal. Just loved the guy. But, you know, he left. And the story that we as fans got told was because, you know, his wife wasn't very happy living in Northamptonshire. And it's so fundamental, isn't it, between from that kind of that point to say, well, if your home's not right, your head's not right, and if your head's not right, you're not going to perform. It's the same with we had George North, you know, was probably one of the best winger in the Premiership for a long time. We loved him. Towards the end of his Saints career, was really not performing for us, and he just wanted to go home, back to Wales. And now look, he's back to fine form again, performing like he was. So there's got to be that connection.
100%. And you see it in football most obviously, when you'll get someone that's come from a lower league club, has been their best player, he goes in a big money transfer to one of the top teams in the league, and just kind of disappears. Like, take Danny Drinkwater or Ross Barkley, you know, for Leicester and Everton respectively, they were phenomenal players. Then they get signed for Chelsea. Drinkwater, actually, they're both Chelsea. Yeah, they both got signed for Chelsea. You know, big money moves. And Drinkwater in particular has just disappeared.
Yeah.
And then it makes you question, well, you don't just lose your talent. You don't just become a bad player. So what other factors have caused him to not hit the dizzy heights that everyone expected him to? And then you start bringing in... And there's this whole thing of, which is really interesting, this argument between individual talent and team structures. Okay. So what makes someone a good player? Is it their individual talent, or is it does the structure of the team allow them to flourish? Does it play to their strengths? So for me... You know, I wasn't a very good rugby player. You know, I wasn't the quickest, I wasn't the strongest or anything like that. But I was part of a team, part of a structure that allowed me to do what I did as best as I could. Mm. If you pick me up and put me in a different, take Saints for example, I could very easily have just disappeared because the way Saints play doesn't, you know. And so you start looking at that, and you set into corporate world, and you kind of go, well, as a team, have we created structure of the team that allows everyone to be good at what they're good at, or are we relying on the individual talents?
Yeah.
And it's that kind of, yeah, those dynamics again, the crossover from sport into corporate, where actually it's no different. Take the job out of it, you're trying to create a system in both situations where you're allowing the people within it to be as good as they possibly can be. So how do we do that? And then we explore those sorts of things.
And there's another thing you said earlier which I quite liked about, like, is that kind of creating an environment in which you're comfortable to be potentially like uncomfortable, you know, like challenging somebody, somebody saying, I don't know, it could be the finance director, for example, saying, this is where we are, blah, blah, blah. And the director of safety, for example, saying, I'm not sure that's right. It's being able to feel comfortable to first do the challenge, but then be challenged as well, because you've got those value, whether you call it values or an aim as a business, as this is where we want to go. And I find startups are quite good at this, is because they're so small and they're so close. We all buy into this business growing and being big or whatever we want it to be, that we're comfortable being challenged because we're all aware that we're on the same train, going the same direction, trying to get to the same outcome, potentially.
Yeah. No, 100%. And a lot of clients we've had is that whole situation where they say, look, we started as this really small organization. We want to be different to all the bigger companies within the market and this, that, and the other, where there's brilliant culture, everyone was on board and all the rest of it. And then you grow really quickly. And then when you grow, all that messaging gets diluted and the culture gets diluted. And all of a sudden you become the very organization that you set out to be different from. And it is that exact reason. And it's, you look again, any successful organization, sport, business, whatever, there is inherent innovation and getting better and improving. And that only comes from questioning what you're doing in the first place. And, you know, if you ask someone why they do something and their answer is, well, it's just the way we've always done it, then what that person is indirectly telling you is that they don't want to learn. That they don't want to get better, you know, and things have to be done the right way. And when you challenge someone or ask someone, I think the problem is people take that very personally. So again, it comes back to this fact of knowing the people you work with, because if you know someone well enough, then you'll know that the only reason they're asking that is actually because they want you to get better, or they want to get better themselves, or they want to help the organization. And if you know that's the reason behind the question, then you're much more likely to look into it and accept it and try and improve it. If you don't know that about the person, then naturally people go, well, hang on, that's a direct kind of dig at me and what I do in my role. So actually, you know what, stuff you, I'm not going to listen. Or what usually happens is they nod, yeah, sure, no worries, their head's going, do one.
Yeah.
I know what I'm doing. You leave me alone, I'm fine. Mm. And that's where then you kind of, as an organisation, sorry, bear with me, my dog's digging a hole in the garden.
No, you're all right.
That's where you get to a point in the organisation where you fall off a cliff without ever actually knowing you're on a cliff in the first place.
Mm.
And I think that's the danger of it. And then people go, oh, I don't know what happened. I don't know how we got to this point where we've had this big issue. And when you look back at it, everyone else will know. And you kind of go, why didn't you say anything? Mm. Oh, well, you know, I was afraid about the repercussions, or I might lose my job, or this. And again, it goes back to that environment where people are comfortable to say everything. And it takes time. And you'll never nail it. Doesn't matter who you are, how good you are, you will always still have people that will have issues. And arguably, there's actually nothing wrong with that, because it's those people that almost keep you honest and keep you thinking and keep you going. But I think it's striving as much as possible to get as close to that nirvana, if you like, as you can. Mm.
There's so much into it. And I do think that one of the reasons why I kind of, when I saw what you were doing with the Saracens Way, and I'd been talking about Saracens for only from what I knew from a fan point of view, but also from seeing the odd interviews and stuff, and seeing what is he doing again?
Keep talking, stop. Yeah, just stand over the hole.
I've got a dog. I know what they're like.
Yeah, nightmare.
And he's got a. So the point was, you know, I was looking at it, and I always talk about it in work or in training. So you've got to create that environment as a performing business, as an innovating business, whatever you want to do. And safety is just one part of those. And I think safety, in my opinion, is just good business. You know, there's an old saying in the safety world, good safety is good business. But what does that mean? Well, if we were to look at the real crux of safety, it's basically good leadership and risk management. Now, every business does that in a day-to-day basis. You go into the finance team, they do that. They're the guy that takes risk in finance is celebrated because you've made loads of money. And a good leader is celebrated, but that's all safety is. Yet we've become this kind of, you know, tick box people, etc. And I'm not towering us all with the same brush. There are some good ones.
No, but I know what you mean.
And that was why I thought, you know what, I need to get Will on and have a chat about this because it's an interesting, different way of looking at it. That all the stuff you're talking about all applies to health and safety, 100%.
Yeah, and listen, it's also really important to stress that by no means am I saying this is how everyone needs to operate. It's kind of, you know, again, I'm a firm believer in you're a product of your experiences and your environments. So my only experience and working environment has been Saris. Mm. So that's all I know. And it's worked superbly for us. And that's how I believe things should be. But I'm not arrogant enough to think that's the only way of being successful. So what we do is kind of, we talk about, this is how we've done it. This is how we've gone about becoming successful. And actually, this is how I think we could apply it to your organisation or your world. But within that, we ourselves as a club, the players have a speaker series where we bring other people in to the club. So guys, people that have climbed Everest, magicians, CEOs, people in the police, to learn from their experiences and to learn how they've become successful. Because the second you think, it's the thing with culture, the second you think you've nailed it is the very start of your decline. You know, it's a living, breathing thing. You never complete culture. It's forever changing because external influences change, people change, ideas change. You know, if you look at our sport changes every single year. There's new rules. There's changes in rules. There's, you know, so you have to be governed by all that stuff. And I think that's a really important part of any culture, is having the adaptability and flexibility to move with the changes, because the second your culture and values become rigid and stiff, they can't flex, they can't move, they can't. It's like and excuse all the horrible cliche analogies, but it's like somebody putting foundations in for a skyscraper. If those foundations are obviously rock solid, but if they cannot move or the building cannot flex or tweak, the second a big gust of wind comes, the whole thing falls out. So they need to be able to move, and they will never change. Like, our values will never change, who we are will never change, but we need to be able to adapt to the current situation and flex and tweak what we do to fit in with the outside world, but staying true to who we are at the same time. And I think that's the important thing, is organizations need to find out who they are first before they can do any of that. you know, why are we here? What are we trying to achieve? And once you've got that common goal, that then governs everything you do. That's the question. You know, if you've got a big decision to make, is it in line with our purpose? Is it true to our why? Is it true to what we're trying to do? And if it is, brilliant. If it's not, okay, well, how do we need to change it? How do we need to flex it? So I think that's a really important part. And, you know, for people that are listening, I'd hate for people to listen and go, Christ alive, he's an arrogant so-and-so, isn't he? Because that's not me at all. It's you know, there's loads, you know, it's 100 ways to skin a cat, isn't there? This is just the way we've done it. And, you know, I'm a firm believer that it's a good way of going about things.
I get what you're saying. I understand, like, the point of being thinking, like, there is 100 ways to skin a cat, 100%. But I do think there are fundamental consistencies in all of the, you know, different systems or different models of leadership or whatever, you know, whether you were to call the Saracen's way, you know, a way to run a business, and then you were to, I don't know, do some other method and some other kind of leadership method, they've all got their consistent things, and that they're kind of, you know, understanding your people, and that family piece, like you were saying, is so interesting, because within safety we've got this mediocre kind of training thing that's very popular called OIOSH Managing Safely, and I used to deliver that a lot. It's a very generic course, but yeah, I used to, when the stress thing came up and we were talking about stress and well-being in there, and I used to say to people, you know, when's the last time you asked the member of your team, because it was managers that were in it, a member of your team, how are you? And they were like, oh, like 10 minutes ago or an hour ago. But when did you say it and actually mean it? Or did you go, hey, Will, how are you? By the way, have you done that report I need you to do? Like,
exactly.
It's a different thing. It's like, hey, Will, how are you? How's the wife? How's the dog? Et cetera, or whatever it is.
It just becomes a box ticking exercise. And what happens is, if you actually just take 5 minutes to have a conversation with someone, you learn more about them. And what happens is you actually then want to have a conversation with them. Because you learn more about who they are, and then you find some common ground, or, you know, you've watched the same movie over the weekend or whatever it is, then you actually want to go and spend time with them, and then you start to form a proper relationship. So there is an element of kind of forced fun, if you like, to begin with, of actually making a conscious decision to go and have a conversation with someone. But the more you do that, that then becomes a very natural and organic process, where what you'll find is you're having a conversation with someone naturally without even realizing that it's kind of a thing. And then what that then leads into is the conversation we had just before this, around when a problem comes up, because some people argue either way, but I think it's much easier to go to a best mate and tell him that he's being a dick than it is to someone you don't know. And if you take that kind of quite crude analogy into the workplace, it's much easier to tell someone you know and like that they've done something wrong than it is someone that you've never even really spoken to before.
No, I agree. It's it's coming back to that point you said earlier. It's like creating that environment where you're comfortable to be uncomfortable, is it? It's an uncomfortable thing to tell your best mate you're being a dick. Oh, it depends how good your relationship
is. Yeah. And what they've done, yeah.
But you've got to be able to create that relationship, I suppose. And I think all of this works for any kind of business. And I think once we stop thinking about health and safety as a standalone thing, and we start thinking about it and how you're talking about business, it's just, we're just talking about leadership, acknowledging a risk and building a business that is resilient enough to adjust and adapt to those risks, whether it's a financial risk, whether it's scandal, whether it's to brand, whether it's health and safety, it doesn't matter, it's all the same.
Yeah, but you almost take the health and safety part out of it, and you just look at the group of people there. Well, how do you get this group of people to buy into what we're trying to do? And then you add in, you know, it's, we talk a lot around the job's the easy bit. You know, the whole reason we have coaches is to coach us to be better rugby players, to upskill us in what we need to be skilled in. The reason managers and senior leaders are at that stage of the business is because the main part of their role is managing their team. It's getting the best out of their people. So in theory, the job's the easy bit. The difficult bit is, how do you get people wanting to come to work every single morning? How do you get people excited about what they're doing? How do you get them to care about what they're doing? And it's by no means saying, look, the reality is not everyone's going to love their job. I was extremely fortunate that I was able to do the very thing I wanted to do and that I love doing. But the real world is very different. And this is a huge, huge generalization. But what I've kind of learned doing the role I do now is that there tends to be kind of three reasons why someone's in a job. It's either because they love it, or it's because it's a stepping stone onto something else, or it's because it's kind of to pay the bills and the mortgage or whatever. Now, there is no right or wrong in that. Every single one is completely just as justified as the other. But the point is until you know why someone's coming in, as I said before, you can never get the most out of them. So, but the reality is, as a leader, you want your whole organizational team to be in that first category. You want them to love what they do, because if they love what they do, they're going to do it better and work hard and all the rest of it. But the reality is that's never going to happen, because not everyone is going to enjoy sitting in an office. Not everyone's going to enjoy sitting in front of a screen. So how do you get the people in the other two categories to get into that first one of loving what they do and getting excited about coming in? Well, you do that by actually creating a situation where they're friends with the people they work with, but they genuinely care about the people they work with. They might hate the physical job, but if they care about the people in their team, there's a much more conscious effort to want to do better for them, if not for themselves. By another way is by actually getting them to understand the bigger picture of the organization. So you get the same outcome. They might hate what they do, but if they know what they do is vital in what the organization ends up doing, and again, they're going to work harder and try and be better and do what they can. So and again, all that comes down to people. You know, the funnel of problems organizations have at the top is so wide. There are so many problems, but fundamentally the solution is so narrow. It all comes down to people.
Mm.
But logistically within that, there are obviously difficulties and you know, nuances, but fundamentally it all comes down to people.
Do you think that was something it might be hard to, well, I suppose it won't be hard to answer. I was going to say maybe could be in a player, you kind of don't see the rest of the business. But do you think that was something that Saracens were quite good at is getting the rest of the business buying into that brand and value as well?
Yeah, I think in terms of kind of the commercial side?
In terms of, you know, from say like the cleaners to the commercial to the kit men to the physios to all that kind of the people behind to be honest, if you're a physio, you probably always wanted to be a physio, but let's say you're the commercial side, you're in the customer services or something like that. That is probably those kind of roles where people are just there to pay the bills. Do you think that was something that Saracens were good at, is you're getting people to buy into the values that everybody was about, that team performing well and just being just the customer services? And I said that in quotations, you know, if you might think, oh, I'm just in customer services, but you're not. You're in customer services, which enables Will and Faz and Maro and et cetera to be what they need to do. What made me think about it, we had a guy from America. He wrote this book called The Belonging Factor and creating a brand that everyone feels, his phrase was belong, you know, it feel like people belong to it. And my challenge to him was the same, was like, it's all well and good from the kind of, I would say like the board level people and senior management upwards, probably they really buy into the brand, et cetera. They want to get this done. Yeah. They're at a high level of their career. They're probably getting paid a lot of money. They might have even trained and become qualified for many years to get to that position. Quite similarly in the world of rugby players, you know, you buy into that brand and that kind of ethos of the team. Well, you know, how do we do that for the cleaners or the doers do you know, people coming in and cleaning Saracen's club or the changing rooms, you know, they've got to feel that sense of belonging. You know, I'm not just cleaning a room, I'm cleaning the lads' changing rooms, and if this is in a terrible condition, then they might not perform as well, etc., etc. It's growing that connection between the end goal, the kind of people on the shop floor, if that makes sense.
I think you're spot on. You need to do it, and there are different ways of going about it, because the reality is, you know, if you take a startup business and you're the person that started the business and it grows, you end up employing 100 people, the last person you employed naturally is not going to have the same motivation and drive as you do to make the business successful, because that's your baby. You know, you've invested time, money, effort into it, and they've been recruited kind of 5 years down the line. So naturally, there's a huge difference there. But that's where kind of the purpose of the organization is so important, where the culture and the values are so important, because if they're right, then that to begin with should govern a huge amount of why you recruit someone in the first place. You know,
you should recruit someone 60-65% on them as a person, whether they'll fit into the organization from a cultural point of view first, and then the other 35-40% is done on actually are they good at the job. Because again, it goes back to the bit that you should always be able to upskill someone to be, you can teach someone to be good at a job. You know, it's a lot harder to teach someone to be a good person. So when you talk about cleaners or whoever it is, one of the ways you get that is actually by, again, very simply, actually going out your way to talk to them, understand them as a person. Just having a conversation with someone gives them a huge sense of value and what they're doing is important. Gratitude's a great one. You know, how many people walk past a cleaner without saying a word? Yeah, and that becomes kind of the norm. But it's so, you know, everyone has equal value. You know, as you say, a cleaner arguably has more importance than a lot of people in an organization. You know, it's actually, you know, when you see anyone in the morning or during the day saying hello, generally, how are you? Or thank you so much for doing that. I really appreciated it. You know, how we get so caught up with emailing nowadays that people will email someone that's in the same room as them, rather than get up and go and have a conversation. You know, if someone's done something well, it'll be a generic thank you email, which is great. But actually, if you go to that person and face to face say, thank you so much, that was brilliant, really appreciate it, that has 20 times more value in sending the email. Do you know what I mean? So it's, again, it's those little bits and understanding. And just doing that alone gets buy-in, because people feel like they're valued as a person, that what they're doing is important. If you can then layer on top of that kind of this bigger picture of what the organisation is trying to do, and they understand their role within that and how actually their role within that is important, however small or big it might be, then that layers on. But it takes time. You know, these things don't happen overnight. And I say to clients that come on our workshops, like, yes, you've hopefully had a good day and it's been interesting, but you're not now going to go away and have a brilliant culture and all know each other unbelievably well because you've done this day. Like, that's just not. This is a rod up the backside, really. You now need to go away and run with this and figure out how you use it in your own context. So it's, and this is why not a lot of people do it, because everyone talks it a good game. Everyone will do it to the point where something goes wrong. And then the point something goes wrong, they go, all right, this isn't working, let's go back to what we did before. When actually at that point when something goes wrong, that's when you need to go, no, this is where we need to completely back what we're doing now. That's where we need to actually get to know each other more, where we arguably need to spend more time away from our desk to actually figure out how we're going to solve this problem rather than just keep churning out whatever we're doing. And that's why these sustained success for organisations and sports teams are few and far between. Because it's the ones that are prepared. There's this whole term, you know, win at all costs. You know, we're going to do this at all costs. We're going to be. And what I often ask is, well, at what cost? So are you prepared to lose in order to win? Are you prepared for something not to work now for it to work in the future? So it's a kind of take sport. Is are you prepared to have two or three seasons where you win nothing in order to build, then win the European Cup in the fourth season? Or do you want to win now, which means that you might never win it again?
That's interesting. I think that reminds me of kind of Eddie Jones's kind of journey of like in the middle. So obviously we had that massive period of just win. And then we just went through this horrendous period where we were really struggling. And I felt like just watching it that Eddie Jones has gone, okay, we've established a base and now is my time to experiment, play around and potentially lose a lot of games to enable us to get to the World Cup final. Granted, we didn't win, but, you know, we got there. I kind of felt that was similar to what you've just said in a way.
Yeah, but you figure out more about yourself as individually and as a group when you go to adversity than when you're winning, I believe. You know, I'm reading a book at the moment where they talk around, there's an element, that section where they talk about Apple. And when Steve Jobs came back to Apple after kind of he left and then came back, you know, he said, they went, simplicity is the height of sophistication. So they kind of had all these products that were doing nothing. And he basically channeled it into four, I think, to begin with. But initially, people go, well, hang on, what are you doing? You know, we're selling 20 products, so we've got 20 revenue streams. Now you want to do four. Like, we're going to take a massive hit here. But then it's kind of, well, no, let's make them the four best four we can, or this. And then everything comes back of it. And I think it's, it's this whole thing of people get scared when things start to go wrong, and understandably so. But if you know in your heart of heart that you've got your, what you're doing is the right way of going about it, if you have a longer term picture and aim, that's not going back to what we said at the very start of this conversation, it's not just a plaster over the bullet wound. Mm. It's actually healing from the inside out. You know, you have to fix the problem. If you keep masking it, then the crack's going to get so big that you can never repair it. And if you know that what you're doing is doing that, even if you're losing a few games, even if commercially you're not getting the same returns or returns you want to, but in 5 years' time, you'll be in a much better situation, a much more sustainable position with much less churn of labour, much less issues and whatever IT, whatever it might be, because you've taken that period to build. And I think that's where in the corporate world, you very rarely see that now, because there is all this, especially big companies with shareholders, you know, the external pressures are phenomenal. And so, but that's what we kind of say, well, you know, the reality is, you say you want to win at all costs, but if you're not prepared to do this, then you don't want to win at all costs, because you don't want to have the cost of losing in order to win. So you need to rethink actually how much you want to do this and why you want to do it. Because a lot of the time, if it's short term, then it's very individualism. It's about me. You know, if I get this right this year, that'll look good on my CV, so I can then go do this. Or if I do this, I can get that promotion. You know, do you know what I mean? It's not. Yeah. And again, there's nothing wrong with that. Don't get me wrong. There's absolutely, if that's the way someone wants to be, then have at it, crack on. But if you're trying to create this team culture, then I think you need to think differently.
I think this relates as well to safety. I think not so much from a point of winning and losing, but for a point of like, if we want to succeed. So for example, we all know that Grenfell happened a fair few years ago, and a lot of businesses have reacted to that and started to really critically analyze how they've managed fire safety for a long time. And now it's like, well, what do you want? Well, we want to make sure that it's never our brand on the telly, Grenfell, or we want to make sure that we never kill 72 people in one of our blocks or flats again, or whatever it is. Whether even if it's like Piper Alpha or anything, these big incidents happen and businesses start to critically analyze themselves. And the loss point of view, from my point of view, it's like, well, that's what you want. So what's stopping us? And no, I'm going to get my words out. I'm trying to say this, trying to bring this from your point to my point. Yeah. So they see those things, and the problem is always, we need it yesterday. So this has happened, we need it right now. So the problem is that they're not willing to wait, is what I'm trying to say. It's like, well, what do you want? We want this. We want to create a good culture, or we want to make sure that we never have a fire, or eliminate all risk, whatever crazy ideas people might have. The problem I come across, and I think most safety professionals come across, is it has to be done yesterday. And that's like, people are not willing to take that loss or take that bit of patience to build this stuff. And this stuff takes time. Like you said, just this journey that Saracens were on was a really long bloody journey. And we see it all the time. But people don't seem to have that patience around things.
No. And the reality is, you'll know deep down if what you're doing is right or wrong. But I think the problem comes, you said, is that people don't give it enough time to know generally whether what they're doing is right or wrong. Mm. You know, if you change at the first setback, and when I say change, obviously if a setback happens, you've got to learn from it, you've got to adjust it, you've got to adapt to it, of course. Yeah. But if you fundamentally change everything you're doing because of one setback, then you won't ever know whether that was what you're doing is right or wrong.
Mm.
You need to learn from that setback, adjust what you're doing, and then go with that and go with this. And I think that's the, but you're right, the patience is, I don't even, maybe patience is the wrong word. I suppose it's probably more just trust, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a belief. It's you know, all this stuff, the greatest organizations, when you speak to the people that are at the forefront of them or whatever, it's more than a belief. Mm. It's a way of life in that what they do is, it's how it's just breathing for them, you know. Do you know what I mean? It's, and again, you're not going to get everyone to that level, but if that filters down, then people will back it more readily. And I think the biggest thing as well is if you're trying to implement this kind of this big purpose or this big belief in what you're doing and all this kind of stuff, all the stuff we've spoken about today, you need to allow people to disagree with it.
Yeah.
You need to allow people to have their moment of saying, well, what about this and what about that? Because firstly, there might be a little diamond in the rough there, a little golden nugget that you can take, oh, actually, I didn't think of that. That's a very good point. Two, by allowing people to have their opinion heard, what you do is immediately give them value. And they feel that they've been listened to and that they've been heard. And so even if they fundamentally disagree with what you're doing, they're much more likely to give it a crack because you've allowed them to voice their opinion.
Yeah.
And three, and maybe the most important one, is actually when someone voices their opinion, everyone else learns more about that person.
Mm.
So if you're in a room of 20 people and one person stands up and goes, well, hang on, but that doesn't make any sense. And why fundamentally disagree because of X, Y, Z? Everyone else will go, oh, Christ, I didn't actually know that about that person.
Yeah.
And you leave the room, even if it's only a little thing, you leave the room knowing that person better than when you came into the room, which means that now you're going to be able to work with them slightly better than you would have before. And then it all layers up. It's just conversations, you know, you learn more about someone in an argument with them than you do in a good conversation with them.
Yeah,
yeah, that's an argument. That's when proper opinions come out. That's when you know, and you know how they're going to react to something, what they're like when they get angry, what their social norms are, what they actually think. Because it's often not until a full blown argument happens that someone generally says what they actually think.
True. So
the point reason I say that is because in disagreements, that's when you learn. Mm. But obviously, there's a way of doing it. And then there has to be an ability, once you've had disagreement, to be able to actually realise that there's an end to it and then deal with it and move on from it. Because you can't have things drag on and on and on, of course. There needs to be an ending to it. But I think the principle applies.
Yeah, there's got to be that kind of structure. And that comes back to what you said earlier, is that kind of, you know, being comfortable in that environment.
Yeah.
And I could genuinely talk to you all day about this. However, I am desperate to talk about the debate at the moment, which is player safety. You know, you told me you were happy to chat about it, and I thought that if we had a safety professional and a rugby player having a conversation, it needs to be had. So let's just start at the top then. Do you think it's gone mad, this kind of player safety?
Not gone mad. I think it's getting mad. Yeah.
Okay. Go on, elaborate if you can.
Elaborate. But I think for me, like, don't get me wrong, I am, as someone that got hurt a lot, I am all for making the game as safe as possible, 100%. You know, there's rugby, what I've learned from having to retire early is that rugby is a very short career. Sport's a very short career. And even as a professional rugby player, you'll spend more of your life working, in inverted commas, than you will playing rugby.
Yeah.
So people need to be looked after so that they can enjoy their families and not sort of cooked 20 years down the line. But the caveat to that is that rugby is a physical sport. You know, I got into playing rugby because I used to go down and watch my old man play for his, you know, the local vets team, and used to see these guys bashing 10 bells of rude word out of each other and then have a beer after and shake hands, you know. And it's that physical. I got into it because there's that physical element to that. As I said, I wasn't very quick or very skillful or anything like that. You know, I just used to kind of put myself about. But so there comes a point where there needs to be an acceptance that if you play rugby, you're going to get hurt.
Mm.
You know, you're going to get hurt. You're going to break a bone. You're going to get concussed. You're going to probably have a surgery if you play to, you know, a decent level and all this kind of stuff. It's just part and parcel of the game. And I think we're getting to the point now where we're making it so safe that we're starting to fundamentally take away the elements of why people play in the first place.
Mm.
Rugby's a completely different sport now to what it was. You know, you watch with lockdown, you know, replaying all the old games and the old lines tests and all the rest of it. And you watch those back in even 05, 09 even, and you go into a different sport. You know, the way the scrum engages, the way people tackle, and a lot of the things like tip tackling, was a definitely right thing to do. You know, the risk of bumping people on their head, like, is just too big a risk to take, particularly with that high tackle. In terms of concussions, the same, but then the high tackles now just get ridiculous, you know. The problem is that there's no a few refs are very good at it. I think, you know, Wayne Barnes obviously notoriously good. The Southern Hemisphere refs, I think, are actually pretty good in terms of understanding the ins and outs and issues around the game. You know, there's some situations where, you know, someone slips and they get caught high and the guy gets red carded. You're kind of looking and going, well, what on earth is he meant to do? There's no way he could change that in 0.1 of a second or whatever it is. So I think we're probably at the ceiling of what we can do to make the game safe without taking the actual purity and essence out of why people love playing and love watching rugby.
I mean, I'm inclined to agree, if I'm honest. Like, there's sometimes... It's difficult, isn't it? Because in the world of social media, everyone's a referee. Everyone knows better than the ref. But you're right. I mean, if you even look at England's most celebrated flyer, if you watch some of Johnny Wilkinson's tackles, you're like, Jesus, that's a red card if I've ever seen one.
And well, there was one. There's a viral clip going around of, I can't remember, maybe South Africa against Wales way back in the day. And I think someone put in this minute clip, there would be 3 red cards and 5 yellow. if that was now. Now, like, we can laugh and joke about it, but I think it's that realization, like, if you don't want to get hurt, then don't play rugby. You know, it's as a professional, part of signing a contract is accepting the inherent risk with what you're about to do. You know, every time you take the field, there's that risk and potential consequence that you're going to come off on a stretcher or whatever it might be. And I think you have, because if you don't accept that, then you're always going to be bitter, or, you know, have these regrets, or you're never going to give yourself to the game because you're going to be worried about, oh, I don't want to do that in case I get hurt, and then you don't maximise what you're able to do. And I think, you know, there's a lot of it is around, you know, grassroots level and kids. And,
yeah, I agree.
And we want as many kids to play the game as possible, and you can argue that's an argument for both sides of the fence, isn't it? You know, you want to make it safe so everyone can play, but then you don't want it to be too safe, then you stop a lot of people. But I think it comes down to that very simple idea of, you know, the reality is if you play this sport, you're going to get hurt. But any sport, you can get hurt. Play cricket, you're going to put them, you know, it's just, and you need to be able to accept that that's just the way it is.
And I think there's an irony in it, because I only dabbled with rugby at school and then didn't really play, and then came into it about 5 or 6 years ago. And my lesson on how to tackle was about 30 seconds before kickoff, this guy just went, the captain went, "Hey, Rob, can you just show you that?" Yeah, I got it. Yeah, do you want to do this? Yeah. And that was it. And I think the irony of all of these conversations is we're debating it at, granted, the strongest, like, and most powerful level of rugby is the Premiership and the Championship and all that. So they hit so much harder, and I get that.
Yeah.
But then on the flip side, you've got all the support. And I think for the RFU as a kind of nation, of their biggest risk is that kind of those people that have come into the sport at a young age but never really was taught the basic fundamentals, because you only get taught the basic fundamentals at your mini juniors and your kids rugby. Yeah. After that, everyone just assumes that if you're going to play rugby, you know how to do this stuff. And some of the stuff I saw playing at that, I mean, just like
a
crap level of rugby, but like some of the stuff I saw, and I just thought, Jesus. and it's like, then the Premiership and that level of rugby is a beast unto itself, and it probably does need, I think, to stop where it is, or maybe just to adjust slightly. But it's what you're doing about the grassroots, like you say, what you're doing about those people who play social rugby that just play it to have a pint with the lads at the end. Because there's so many injuries at that level, and you haven't got the, you know, you can't, when I started playing, the club I played for, we were in the magazine for putting 7 teams out. By the time I left, we struggled to put 2 or 3 teams out.
Yeah.
So it's like, we haven't got the bench to be able to say, right, you're injured, come off. So you're getting people that are injured and still playing, you know, a full game.
But you're spot on, because it's, I mean, one thing that we've learned, almost kickstarted by what happened to us, is that rugby as a sport is not governed well at all. You know, whether it's prayer or RFU or whatever. And I think one of the, you're right, I think what they've gone about it kind of back to front in a way, because it's, they've kind of used the professional game to bring these new rules in, I'm assuming because it's kind of the visual example. And if we do it at that level, then everyone will follow and all the rest of it. Mm. But actually, if you're going to make it a genuine change, then you ask someone to go the other way. Mm. And you need to be teaching this to kids at the very earliest possible moment. You need to be teaching it at grass level sports. If someone like yourself hadn't played for a while and then come back into it, you know, there needs to be a protocol before you should be able to allow to play a game that you've done, and that you've done your tackling practice, you've done your ruck, whatever it might be. Yeah. And then what happens then is, as these people grow up and these kids become professionals, that's what they've been doing their entire lives. So it becomes a very natural way to then play the game. The problem you've got professional level, and it's getting better now, but when they started introducing them a few years ago, you've got 6'5", 6'6" guys that have been taught their entire life to tackle kind of chest on chest because they're that big, and to go up top because that's when you can melt someone. That's they've been taught. And then you're asking them to tackle a 5'9" little lad around the waist, and that's when actually you want to get more concussions, because that's when you get head on the wrong side, you take a knee in the chops, you get a hip pointer on your temple, whatever it might be, because you're fundamentally asking people to change 15 years worth of knowledge in a day.
Yeah, you know, muscle memory, I suppose, isn't it? Like, I suppose.
Yeah, but it's like anything in life. If you've done something a certain way, and as we said, everyone needs to change it. But if you've done something a certain way for 10 years, whether you're changing for the right reason or for the wrong reason, it's very difficult. You need to give people the time. Again, it comes back to time. But yeah, the problem with the rugby is they didn't give anyone the time. Mm-hmm. You know, they made overnight these massive changes and expected everyone to be bang on it. Rather, look at VAR in football. Mm. You know, they went boom forward with doing everything straight away, and it's all gone to pot. Whereas, and listen, like, I have no authority to talk about anything to do with any other sport, really, not even rugby, really, to be fair. But you think in hindsight, they should have just used it potentially for offsides, and that's it, and let that get embedded, and get then they bring in maybe penalty decisions that get embedded, and go bit by bit. Because look at the goal line technology, everyone was against that, and now it's just part and parcel of the sport. So I think with where we rugby screwed up is they didn't give the professional game enough time to actually react to these rule changes. And I think we're getting better now, but there'll be, the problem is, it's one of the few sports in the world that changes its rules every single year.
Yeah.
Or even halfway through a season changes its rules. You know, you look at the scrum every year, you get the refs in pre-season to do a session where they're basically telling the entire squad what the new rules are or what the new kind of hot bits they're looking at are, which were different from last year. Mm. So it's constantly, you know, this whole thing of being able to adapt, and as players, generally, we're pretty good at it, but it's just still going to happen.
How much do you think, like, the fans and social media kind of has an impact on this stuff? Because it's like the perfect picture of irony that, like, say for it, Saints fans are probably one of the worst. You know, everyone loves Courtney Laws. He's our favourite player. And, you know, I love him to bits, you know, proper Northamptonshire born and bred lad. Yeah. Absolutely love him. And, you know, watching him fold in, like, French fly halves in half, and you're like, yeah. And then the second somebody does that to one of our players, we're screaming for a card. And we're saying that the ref was one-sided. And how do you think it's kind of like trial by social media, and that the RFU is inadvertently or maybe subconsciously put under pressure by the public?
Yeah, I think that's just life in general now, to be honest.
Yeah, true.
It's the power of social, and this is probably a whole podcast in itself, but the power of social media is enormous. I mean, you know, you look at the moment, the good side of it in terms of the amount of money that's being raised. You know, there's the war veteran, we've got the Captain Thomas Moore, I think his name is, he's raised over £5 million, you know, and you see the influence from a good point of view like that. And then obviously, you know, for various topics, we've seen the other side of it. But I think with sport, of course, it's, you know, it's like, I often liken it to, you know, like when you go on holiday, and you look for a hotel on TripAdvisor, and you've got 10 brilliant reviews. Then you get one bad review, And it's that one bad review that stops you booking that hotel, as opposed to the 10 good ones. Even if it's got 5 stars, someone thought the rooms were a bit dirty. Well, I'm not going to go
Didn't
there.
Didn't have tea making facilities.
Exactly. Yeah, you can get 1,000 brilliant tweets about something that you've done. Mm. Then you get 10 bad ones, and they're the ones you go. And obviously, you need to look at them and evaluate them for whether they're legit or not. But I suppose the point is that it doesn't take a lot of negative press for people to want to change something.
True.
But it takes a huge amount of positive press for it to keep going. Like, so it's always, the scale is always in balance, I think, from that point of view.
Are the players involved in the conversations around like potential law changes? So like you were saying, that's fundamental in the kind of implementing the Saracens way within a business, is that kind of involvement of your employees, having those conversations, allowing them the opportunity to disagree. Does rugby union and lawmakers, do they follow that kind of rule as well, or is it do-it-the-old?
My honest answer is I don't know. Because I never played to a high enough level to kind of even be part of those kinds of conversations. Talking to good mates that are at that level, they are involved in a lot of stuff around player welfare and international seasons and all that. They are involved in those conversations. I'm assuming, I think some of them, I don't know to what extent they're involved or if they're just kind of asked for their opinion. I don't know. But I think there are some conversations at that level that go on. But the honest answer is I don't really know, to be honest. Put it this way, I was never asked. But I probably should never have been asked. So that was the right thought.
Yeah. Fair enough. Right, mate. Yeah. I'll let you let you get on with your day. I think that's been quite a fascinating conversation. But if anyone's listening to this and they want to kind of engage with yourself and the Saracens way, what's the kind of best way to do that? Obviously, we'll link all the websites and stuff in the description as well. But perfect. Like, how does that work and what's it look like and how they do it?
Yeah, so obviously there's a website, there's my email, so willfraser@saracens.net. Look me up on social media, @Will_Fraser89. Just if you want to learn more about what we do or anything's kind of struck a chord from this, then just drop me a note and hopefully we can do something about it.
Awesome. And if the Premiership was running fully normal, who would have won it this year?
Well, I would say probably Chiefs, but the top four would have been very interesting.
It would have, wouldn't it? It's a real
shame. I think you guys are on a good run. Sale are there. Trying to think who else is not. Bath, I think we're knocking around it. But
it would have shifted towards the end, didn't it?
Sale bloody coming up. Great guns. And you boys started the season phenomenally well.
Yeah, and then had a bit of a dip.
But I think you would have been in the mix for sure. But yeah, I mean, just on historical and having played against them in numerous finals, I'd probably say Chiefs.
Yeah. I mean, I went to watch Chiefs and Saris a few years ago in the final. Will Chudley was playing, so it must have been a few years
ago. Would have been what I played in that one. That would have been when we won the double.
Yes, yeah, it was. Yeah. I remember thinking, because Chudders comes from the club I used to play for in Northamptonshire. And so I was full on a Chiefs fan that day. Yeah. And to watch him get beat, I was like, oh, for God's sake. But yeah, I think it was a great game. But yeah, I remember that.
It was a great game. I had a stinker, to be fair, but we won. So it was,
That'll do, yeah. My wife broke her leg at the time, like about 3 weeks before maybe, so she was in the cash and we were like, cheap tickets at the top of Twickenham, and rang them up and was like, look, I either need my money back or can we get disabled seats? So we're like, yeah, get disabled seats. We're like right at the front row, in the middle of the pitch. It was like, oh, so good.
Nice, happy right. days.
Yeah, probably not as good as a view that you had, but still very good.
Yeah, well, yeah. You say that, you've got big 27 men running at you. So yeah,
that's a good point, actually. I think I prefer my seat. Right, mate. Thank you very much. That was a really good chat.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me on.
Okay, guys. I hope you enjoyed that. It was just a fantastic opportunity for me. Something I never thought I would get to do is interview a Premiership winning rugby player. It's like proper. like, just didn't even, I'm just crazy. It's just, I just, so, I can't believe I didn't fanboy through the whole thing, if I'm honest. You know, when he's just sitting there casually mentioning Owen and Farrell was Faz, and you know, just Owen Farrell's like pretty much England's best fly half, debatable, but that's what I think, anyway. And he's just like, yeah, like Faz, and I'm just like, Faz. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed that podcast. Yeah, I mean, it was just, there's so much to that, isn't there? Like, so yeah, I really hope I didn't fanboy too much and you enjoyed that. And I hope that you took something away from it and you didn't get bored of it being like a rugby chat and remembered what I said in the beginning, which was use this and listen to what we're talking about. Like, forget that we're talking about rugby and listen to the kind of golden thread of what we're talking about, which is leadership and culture, which transforms across everything, like I said in the beginning. So I hope you enjoyed that podcast. If you did, give us a like or drop us a comment. If you're on listening on Anchor, you know, drop us a voice message. If you're on iTunes, please give us a rating review. We would absolutely love that. And if you do, screenshot it, send it to us on all the social medias, which are on your screen, like just here right now, if you're watching on YouTube. If you're not, you're listening on podcasts and you don't understand a word I've just said because you're not watching, then it's Twitter, Rebranded Safety. It's Facebook as Rebranded Safety. LinkedIn now has our own LinkedIn page, so Rebranding Safety. It's pretty much Rebranded Safety on all the platforms. Yeah. Come check us out. Come talk to me. I'd love to talk to all of you. I'd love to know who you are, what you're doing, etc. So just engage with us. You're on YouTube, drop us a comment below, whether you like this or not, whether you'd like to hear from more rugby players or whether you'd like to hear from different sports stars, and I'll see what I can get going on the old social. I'll catch you next week in the podcast. Safe.